It looks like we're all here and we're ready to go. I know I just heard Mr. Erickson talking, and so can you hear me, Mr. Erickson?
I can, yes. I can
Thank
hear
you.
everyone.
I'm Mr. Stockmeyer. Can you hear me?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are either of you anticipating a client? I know that we're starting early, and I appreciate that you're available to do this. Okay, then we will get started. I'll ask the marshal to call the case.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Flory, Judge Frisch, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Calling the case A20-0387, State of Minnesota versus Russell Allen Doucette.
And counsel, we are recording this hearing. So at the beginning of your argument, would you please state your name and the client that you're representing? If at any time you can't hear us, wave your arms or something. We want to make sure that everyone can hear and see what's going on. So with that, Mr. Erickson.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Anders Erickson, and I represent the appellant this morning, Russell Doucette. After a jury trial, Mr. Doucette was acquitted of criminal vehicular homicide and convicted of second-degree culpable negligence manslaughter. Mr. Doucette is requesting that this court reverse his manslaughter conviction because the state failed to prove his guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. There are two reasons why the state failed to prove Mr. Doucette's guilt. First, the state did not establish that Mr. Doucette's conduct of driving the truck away from Mr. Oletsky created an objectively unreasonable risk of great bodily harm or death. And second, the state did not prove that Mr. Doucette had a subjective understanding that driving away from Mr. Oletsky created a risk of great bodily harm or death, that he then disregarded that known risk. I would like to start this morning by discussing the state's failure to establish the subjective element of the offense. The difference between civil negligence and criminal negligence is that the state must prove that the defendant actually knew that there was a risk of great bodily harm or death and consciously disregarded that risk. As a result, the narrow question that this court must decide is whether the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Doucette knew at the time he drove the truck away from Mr. Oletsky that there was a great risk of bodily harm or death. The state did not establish this element for two reasons. First, the state did not present any direct evidence of Mr. Doucette's knowledge. Mr. Doucette never stated that he knew his conduct created the risk of great bodily harm or death, and there were no statements by anybody else that would be considered direct evidence. And
well,
second,
let me ask you this. I looked at the pictures, and it's hard for me to understand exactly what happened because there are varying reports about what happened. But I saw the pictures where the victim was found the next morning where he was lying. And it seems reasonable to me that if someone is hanging on my pickup truck, that instead of speeding away, I would stop. And your client was aware, because the passenger side door opened, that the victim was hanging on to his truck.
Well, I think there are a couple of different things there. One is what I'm arguing right now is the subjective element, and that at that exact time, he knew that his conduct, there was a great risk of great bodily harm.
And that's what I'm getting to. It seems like if someone's hanging on to my car, my subjective knowledge would be that I should stop because people slip, all kinds of bad things can happen with cars, with people hanging on to them.
Well, one, I don't know that there is actually direct or a circumstance proved that he was holding on to the car at the time he drove away. The only evidence is that the door shut and then he accelerated at that time. But again, even if that is a reasonable inference that you're talking about, it also has to disprove any other reasonable inference. And there are other reasonable inferences that at that time, he did not know that the conduct of merely pressing the gas pedal and going forward would do more than just cause the wheels to spin, but would result in somebody falling underneath the truck being run over and killed. I think it's a reasonable inference that he did not know that at that time. So even if there is, you know, exactly what you talked about, that there's a chance that, you know, someone might slip and fall and something bad could happen, that doesn't necessarily disprove the other reasonable inference that he did not know it at that time.
I'm not entirely sure how that is a reasonable inference from the circumstances proved, because the circumstances proved, I mean, I characterize him a little bit differently than you, counsel. I don't think that he was necessarily driving away from him. I think the circumstances proved established that they were alongside of each other for a period of time when the door opened, and then your client floors it. I mean, that's the words in the record. He floored it. And he had already known that there was a traction problem when he floored it that second time. And so I'm not quite sure how you're arriving at an alternative reasonable inference here on the subjective element.
Yeah, well, first, I think it's important that the record doesn't establish that Mr. Doucette, the car stopped. It was constantly moving.
Right.
It slowed down. Mr. Doucette said in one of his statements that the door opened and closed in a half of a second. So it's not like he was hanging on socializing with him at the side of the car and then drove off. It was a matter of a half of a second, door opened, closed, he drove off. So I think while there might be an inference that somebody, that a reasonable person might think at that time, you know, something bad could happen, given that there's not any more evidence than just that half second of him knowing he's at the side of the car and then he drives off, I think that's also a reasonable inference that that's what he knew at that time. And again, it's not this objective, you know, what we would all think a person would think at that time. It's what did Mr. Doucette know at that time? And that's the big difference between criminal negligence and civil negligence, is that we're not just going to talk about it Monday morning quarterback of what he could have known or should have known or what we would think we would know. It's actually what did he know at that time? And I also think it's important to kind of clarify a couple of the other facts. The state mentions in their brief that there were problems with the truck, that the drivetrain was broken, and that Mr. Doucette had made statements about that. Well, the state didn't provide any evidence that that was the cause of the accident, or that Mr. Oletsky's death was somehow caused by that malfunction in the car. It was just an offhand comment that Mr. Doucette made during the interview that he knew that the car needed to be fixed. So the state didn't take that next step and actually prove that there was some sort of causation between the mechanical issues with the truck and the actual incident. And also, as I mentioned in my reply brief, I think it's important that this idea that Mr. Doucette had been drinking or that he had been smoking marijuana, there's no evidence that one, that impaired his ability to drive. Only evidence we have are the statement by a witness who talked to him the next day, and Mr. Doucette's admission that he may have smoked marijuana a few hours before. One, we don't know that that impaired his driving. There's no evidence of it. There's no expert that came and testified. There's no blood alcohol test or anything like that. And second, even if he was impaired, that wouldn't affect whether he knew something or not. That's the very specific issue that we're talking about here, is his knowledge at the time, not some sort of objective test. So I think it's really important to consider the impairment argument in context of actually what was going on. And also, you know, back to what Judge Frisch was talking about, what he knew at the time, the fact that maybe the ground was wet and that the tires had spun, that I think it's not a reasonable leap to assume that everybody would believe that because the grass was wet and his tires had spun earlier, that therefore somebody would die as a result of that condition that existed. I don't think that that necessarily disproves the reasonable inference that he did not know at the time that this would cause great bodily harm or death.
But I mean, there are other circumstances that were proven that are seem to undercut your argument. He, you know, the victim was purposely putting himself in harm's way. The truck was fishtailing, and when the truck was floored the first time. And so I'm still struggling with how is it a, what is the reasonable inference from all of these circumstances that show that he didn't have a, he didn't satisfy the subjective factor that, that the evidence didn't satisfy that second factor.
Well, there's no evidence that the truck fishtailed prior to the incident. It was only after the fact he thought, well, yeah, maybe at the time that he remembers it fishtailing, that's when the death
spinning
took place. That's correct. So, you know, I think we have to really look at this record carefully and what he said and what he didn't say and how it was connected to actually when the tragic death took place. And again, all we're talking about, is there a reasonable inference that he did not know that bodily harm, rape, bodily harm, or death? It's not that something bad would happen. It's not that an accident would happen. It's not that the tires would spin. It's not that the car would fishtail. It's that this extreme, I mean, when we read through this record, when you think about, when you read what happened prior and then what the result of that was, there's a disconnect there, at least when I read the record. And I think that goes directly to what he would know at that time, that it wouldn't be this giant leap to from tires spinning or maybe the car fishtailing or wet grass to somebody slipping and falling and being run over by the truck. So, and again,
what about the evidence in the record though, Mr. Erickson, regarding appellant's conduct the next day while he was still at his friend's house before he returned and found the body, things like not returning to the farm in the morning to feed the animals, which is his normal process, and his behavior that day that seemed out of sorts. Wouldn't that also be, I guess, evidence that from which could be inferred that he did have knowledge that something was amiss at the farm from the night before?
Yeah, Your Honor, I think we're kind of talking about two different things. I think what you're talking about is what he knew happened after it happened.
No, I'm talking about what he believed may have happened when he left the farm that night based upon his behavior the next day.
Right, absolutely. And that his conduct after supports an inference that he knew he ran him over. That's not the question here. The question here is, at the time it happened, did he know before it happened, did he know that his conduct would create a risk of great bodily harm or death? The question of whether he knew he ran him over after the fact goes to the vehicular homicide charge, which he was acquitted of. But even if we want to say that that evidence is strong evidence that he knew what happened after the fact, that doesn't have anything to do or any relevance to his knowledge before he pressed the gas pedal. That's the question we have to ask here, is did he subjectively know at the time he decided to floor it that that conduct would result in great bodily harm or death? So okay.
This is part of the problem that I'm having. You aren't arguing that the jury instructions or evidentiary rulings were wrong. And so what we're left with is a jury who heard all of this testimony, including people who testified on behalf of the state about what your client told them afterwards about what happened, and he made some pretty incriminating statements in my view to them. And so why aren't you asking us to insert our view of the evidence instead of the jury's view and the jury's verdict?
Well, what I'm arguing,
there's a lot of evidence. I mean, you point to certain evidence, but there's a lot of other evidence in the record that the jury heard and saw.
Absolutely. But what I'm articulating is the circumstantial evidence test. And you apply the circumstantial evidence test to the subjective element of this offense.
Deference to those facts that support the jury's verdict.
Well, you figure out what the circumstances proved are, and then you give no deference between guilt or innocence once you determine what the circumstances proved are. So looking at everything we've talked about, if it's a circumstance proved that he knew he drove over Mr. Oletsky, if that's a circumstance proved, there may be an inference from that he knew that there would be great bodily harm or death from stepping on the gas pedal. But there's also a reasonable inference, even if he knew at the time that it was happening, what was happening, that beforehand, he did not know that his conduct had the potential of causing great bodily harm or death. That's the question. We're applying the circumstantial evidence test. There's no deference once we get through the circumstances proved between reasonable inferences. So yes, it's hard to say that we're second guessing a jury's verdict, but that's kind of what we do when we apply the circumstantial evidence test. And I think it's really important to know the difference between the facts after the incident and before, because what he did after has nothing to do with his knowledge at the time he made the decision. It's a negligent decision. It's not him not stopping after the fact. That's not where the negligence is alleged. That goes to the criminal vehicular homicide charge, which he was acquitted of. So I think it's really important to differentiate between the facts after and the facts before. I see my time is running out here. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I can respond in rebuttal. Thank you.
And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Attorney for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors, counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing this morning on behalf of respondent, the state of Minnesota. I think I'll focus, as my friend did, on the subjective element and the evidence of his knowledge of the risks that were posed to the victim. And so our brief discusses the facts in detail, but I really want to focus on two categories of facts. And those are, what did the appellant know, and what did he do in light of what he knew? So in terms of what he knew before he even got in the truck, this comes from his statements to the officer, that there was an issue with the truck's drivetrain. In fact, he said that's why he wanted to circle around the property and leave by the driveway, because he didn't want there to cause any more issues with the truck. So we know he was, his knowledge about the difficulties with the drivetrain were affecting the way he drove the truck. He then knew that as he drove around on the grass, that problem with the drivetrain was causing him to lose traction with the truck. Then when he did this juke move to try to get around the victim, his statements indicate that he lost traction again once he hit the grass. And then he knew that the victim was running alongside the truck, manipulating the car door. And so the question is, what did he do in light of all that knowledge? And what he did comes from his own statement. He simply floored it. He knew that he was having difficulty maintaining traction. He knew that there was somebody directly beside the car manipulating the car door handle, and he decided to floor it. And I think it is simply an unreasonable inference to say that in light of what he knew, that he somehow could not have known that there was a risk of great bodily harm to the victim. I think what's really going on here is there's this sense that, or what my friend is really relying on is this idea that there's only a threat to a person who's standing directly in front of the vehicle. The problem with that is that first of all, I don't think that's true as a matter of just general driving. I don't think it's at all clear that the drivers aren't supposed to be aware of what's going on to their sides. But the problem for this case is that he was having so much difficulty maintaining control over this vehicle. And so he knew, he must have known that there was a risk to the person who was directly beside the vehicle manipulating the car door handle.
You know, Mr. Stockmeyer, a person can have difficulty controlling a vehicle just because they're driving too fast or they're accelerating too fast. Is there this whole drivetrain argument, quite frankly, seems rather weak to me, because I didn't see anything in the record that told us what was wrong with the drivetrain. And I would imagine many things could be wrong. But it's talked about more in a generality. So I don't know how much emphasis we should give this whole drivetrain argument without more information as to what he actually knew in terms of what the actual problem was. Is there something in the record in that regard?
Your Honor, I guess I want to come at that question from two directions. First is, I actually don't think that the exact nature of what was wrong with the drivetrain is really important. What's important here is that he knew he was having difficulty maintaining control over this vehicle, and he knew that before he decided to floor it. But we can dig deeper at what is the level of his knowledge. And if we dig deeper, the record reveals that he knew before he even got into the car that there was a problem with the drivetrain.
What was the problem that he knew?
He said that there was a problem with the drivetrain, and that's why he wanted to exit the property by the driveway. He made a comment about the axle sitting in the back. I'm not really sure what exactly that means. But my point is, he not only did he know that he couldn't maintain control over the vehicle, he knew that it's because there was a problem with the vehicle, and he chose to floor it nevertheless. But even if you're not convinced that the part about the issue with the drivetrain is really dispositive here, the important part is he knew he was having trouble maintaining control over this vehicle. He had driven it around the property on the grass. The officer made note that he had noted points even before the driveway where there appeared to be skid marks in the grass. And the defendant stated that before he hit the victim, he fishtailed in the truck. And so that's the important point, is that he knew he was having difficulty driving in a straight line in this vehicle, and he knew there was a person directly beside the truck, and he decided to floor it nevertheless. I would, unless there are any further questions about the subjective element, I would like to just touch on the dispute we raised about the standard of review on the objective element. And the rule for the objective element is really simple, and that is that when the criminal statute tasks the jury with making a qualitative judgment about a set of facts, the traditional evidence standard of review applies. So for an example, in McCormick, which is the exact statute that's at issue here, the jury had a set of facts based on the defendant's statements, and the statute tasks them with making a qualitative judgment about those facts. Was the defendant's conduct, or did the defendant's conduct grossly deviate from what a reasonable person would do? Similarly, in the Robinson case that we cite in this brief, the jury had a set of facts about the relationship between the victim and the defendant, and the Domestic Abuse Act tasked them with making a qualitative judgment about the nature of that relationship. Was it a significant relationship? And so the key thing about these two cases is that when it's a qualitative judgment that the jury is tasked with making, they're not inferring one historical fact from some other set of facts. Rather, they are assessing the nature of the facts that they are given. And as the Supreme Court stated in Robinson, when that is the case, the courts have to defer to the jury's qualitative assessment of things. And really, that's sort of the prototypical job of the jury, to make those sorts of judgment calls about the facts. And ordinarily, appellate courts don't step in and intrude upon that judgment. And unless this court has any further questions, I'd simply ask that this court affirm Mr. Doucette's conviction. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Anders?
Thank you. Just quickly, the whole idea with this drivetrain, his knowledge regarding that would only be relevant if the state presented evidence that somehow had anything to do with the incident. If there was an expert that came in that looked at the truck and said, this would cause the truck to do X, Y, and Z. The state didn't present any sort of evidence regarding what was wrong with the truck, whether or not it affected the incident that took place. So I think that's a red herring in this case, and the state didn't even argue it below because it's just not relevant because the state didn't connect the dots between any issue and what took place. As far as the objective element regarding the standard of review, you know, I think I clearly articulated our position in our reply brief. Our position is that, you know, you still have to infer from the facts, one, what a reasonable person would do, and then whether the defendant's conduct actually breached that standard. So our position is that there's actually two inferences that need to be made. And this case is very different than in Robinson. In Robinson, there were specific statutory elements where they described what the relationship, how the relationship with the victim would be considered significant. So the jury only had to connect the dots between the facts and the specific factors within the statute. Here, there aren't any factors for the jury to consider. They had to infer what the standard of care was and then infer whether there was a breach of that standard of care. So we're asking that this court, additionally, I think it's important that in McCormick, I don't know if that issue was actually litigated. It seemed like the court reached the conclusion that it was circumstantial evidence, but it doesn't look like it was litigated to the extent that it's litigated today. So I think this court could overrule McCormick if it feels it needs to and apply the circumstantial evidence standard of review. If the court doesn't have any other questions, we request that you reverse Mr. Doucette's conviction.
Thank you, counsel. The case was well briefed, and we will have our decision out within the 90 days.